It's quite a long passage today, but it's one that it's an exciting story, and I've asked John to come and read it to us. So it's 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 1 to 54.
Now the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Succoth in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes-Dami between Succoth and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle lines to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another, with the valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. He was over 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head and wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod, and its iron points weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why do you come out and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not the servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." And the Philistine said, "This day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other." On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite named Jesse, who was from Bethlehem in Judah. Jesse had 8 sons, and in Saul's time he was old and well advanced in years. Jesse's 3 oldest sons had followed Saul to the war. The first one was Eliab, the second Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 oldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to tend his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward every morning and evening and took his stand. Now Jesse said to his son David, "Take this heifer of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread for your brothers, and hurry to their camp. Take along these 10 cheeses to the commander of their units. See how your brothers are, and bring them back some assurance from me. They are with Saul and all the men of Israel in the valley of Elah, fighting against the Philistines." Early in the morning, David left the flock with a shepherd, loaded up, and set out, as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and greeted his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. When the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, "You see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel." David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" They repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, "This is what will be done for the man who kills him." When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? With whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down here only to watch the battle." "Now what have I done?" said David. "Can't I even speak?" He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. David said to Saul, "Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him." Saul replied, "You're not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. "You're really a boy, and he has been fighting a fighting man from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Then Saul dressed David in his own tunic, and he put a coat of armor on him and a bronze helmet on his head. David fastened on his sword over the tunic and tried walking around because he was not used to them. "I cannot go in these," he said to Saul, "because I'm not used to them." So he took them off. Then he took his staff in his hand, chose 5 smooth stones from the stream, put them in the pouch of his shepherd's bag, and with his sling in his hand, approached the Philistine. Meanwhile, the Philistine, with his shield bearer in front of him, kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was only a boy, ruddy and handsome, and he despised him. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you come at me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. "Come here," he said, "and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." David said to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands." As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell face down on the ground. So David triumphed against the Philistine with a sling and a stone. Without a sword in his hand, he struck down the Philistine and killed him. David ran over and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword and drew it from the scabbard. After he killed him, he cut off his head with the sword. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged forward with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath and to the gates of Ekron. Their dead were strewn along the Sha'arim road to Gath and Ekron. When the Israelites returned from chasing the Philistines, they plundered their camp. David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, and he put the Philistine's weapons in his own tent.
Thanks, John. Thanks for your patience with that long reading, but I think you need to get the whole story, you know, because it's one of the most exciting stories in the Old Testament for me. A moment from our house this morning, John was practicing that reading and he said, "Am I a dog that you should come at me with sticks?" And Bethan said, "Yes, and Bethan is a cat and Johan is a sheep." So I thought I'd share that with you. I actually chose this because it is one of my children's favourite Bible stories at the moment, so I've been reading it to them nearly every night recently. But I think it's important sometimes to revisit some of these stories because if we just think of them as Sunday school stories or children's stories, then we miss such a lot. Sometimes we think we know what they're about, but actually when we go back and read them closely, God's got so much in there that he wants to speak to us about. So hopefully some of what I've found in reading it will also be relevant for you today as well. I'm going to start with a question. If somebody were to eavesdrop on your thoughts, would they guess that you have a living God? If someone were to eavesdrop on your conversations when you speak to other people, maybe about situations in your life, would they guess that you have a living God? Well, let me put it like this. If an alien were to arrive on Earth and land in Morrison's car park at 11:55 a.m. on a Sunday, so that he misses the service and just about makes it to Penrallt in time for coffee time, and if that alien were to eavesdrop on our conversations, on what we were saying to one another, would that alien guess that we have a living God? Would he even hear God's name being spoken at all? Just leave you to think about that for a minute. If you read the first 25 verses of that chapter that John's just read, 1 Samuel 17, you might be forgiven for thinking that King Saul and the Israelites didn't have a living God, didn't believe in a living God. They're behaving as though God doesn't exist. In fact, God isn't mentioned at all in that first half of the chapter. It's what we call a godless narrative. And of course, if the Israelites and Saul didn't serve a living God, things would indeed seem pretty bleak for the Israelites. So the situation they're in, they're in a bit of a stalemate against the Philistines. They've got this valley with two hills, one on each side. And on one hill, you've got the Israelite army. And on the other hill, you've got the Philistine army. And suddenly, out of the Philistine camp, strides their champion, clanking down the hill. You can imagine it like a scene from a film. First, they just hear this thud, thud, thud of his giant booted footsteps. And they hear the earth trembling. And you can imagine the camera zooming in on a glass of water, just rippling each time one of his feet touches down. And then they see him, and he's taller than the tallest member of the local basketball team. He's taller than Jonathan Retallick, who's the tallest person I think I know. And he's covered from head to toe in this heavy armour, the body like a tank, legs like tree trunks. And he's not just got one weapon, he's got three. He's got a sword, he's got a spear, and it says he's got a bronze javelin slung on his back as well. And then in this booming voice like a foghorn, he calls out to the assembled ranks of Israel and he dares them to take him on. He dares them to send a man to engage in single combat. And this happens every day for 40 days and nobody dares go. And in verse 11 of chapter 17, it tells us how King Saul and the Israelites reacted to Goliath. It says this: on hearing the Philistines' words, Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. And after all that build-up with that description of Goliath, we can hardly blame them, can we? Now, in the Bible, we don't often get detailed descriptions like this of what people look like or what they're wearing. But in verses 5 to 7, the picture that the narrator paints of Goliath is a very vivid picture. It tells you exactly how much his weapons weighed. It tells you what he was wearing. It tells you how tall he was. And that is quite unusual. But if we've been reading 1 Samuel up till now carefully, there's one thing we should have learned by now, and it's that size isn't everything. And there's two other key characters in the chapter who tell us this, in the book of 1 Samuel, who tell us this. And interestingly enough, they're both mentioned in this chapter too, chapter 17. First, there's Saul, who's the king of Israel. And he's described in 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 23, as being a head taller than any of the others. And you might think that if Saul was so tall and strong, he might go out to face Goliath. But no, he's like all the rest of the Israelites, he's dismayed and terrified. And we also know by chapter 17 that Saul's kingship isn't actually going very well at all. In fact, to the point where in chapter 16, God is instructing his prophet Samuel, who we've heard a lot about earlier in the service. He's instructing Samuel to anoint a new king. And Samuel is sent in chapter 16, just prior to this chapter, to the family of Jesse, who has 8 sons. And Samuel, in his mind, he obviously still equates height with kingliness, because he sees Jesse's oldest son, Eliab, and he thinks, yeah, this must be the one. He's tall, he's handsome. But chapter 16, verse 7 says this, and this is really important to bear in mind for our encounter with Goliath. Chapter 16, verse 7 says this, "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" Say that again. "The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." And of course, following on from that, Samuel, prompted by God, secretly anoints David as the next king. And David's just a boy. He's the youngest of the 8 sons. The message clearly from 1 Samuel is that size isn't everything. And when we see Goliath, this 9-foot-tall man, really, we should remember that as readers, shouldn't we? Because it was only in the last chapter. The Lord doesn't look at the things man looks at. The Lord looks at the heart. And I like this sentence, which is from one of the commentaries I read by Dale Ralph Davis. He says, "We must see that 16 verse 7 applies both to our finest choices and to our most formidable enemies." I really like that. It applies both to our finest choices and to our most formidable enemies. Saul and the Israelites are looking at their situation from a human point of view. They're living in a godless narrative. They can only see Goliath's size and his armour, and they're shaking in their boots. But then in verse 12, David comes along. Now, just a quick aside here about David's mission. One of the things I love about David's mission here is that it seems so mundane. 3 of his big brothers are fighting in the war, so his dad asks him to take some bread and cheese to the front line and to find out a little bit of news about the war. He doesn't tell him, go and fight the Philistine champion. No, he says, take a bit of bread and cheese and find your brothers. And God interrupts him and he calls him into the heart of the battle. So it made me think, what are the mundane things that we do every day, every week? School runs, changing nappies, visiting friends, caring for elderly or ill relatives, commuting to work, going to the supermarket. We might feel like our tasks are mundane, but any moment God might interrupt those tasks and he might want to pull us into the middle of the action. So let's be alert for God's interruptions of our daily tasks, because he might have exciting adventures in store for us. So whilst David is delivering the bread and cheese to his brothers, he hears Goliath come along and do his daily speech where he taunts the Israelites. And then in verse 26, something happens which hasn't yet happened in the whole Bible. David speaks. David's already been mentioned in several chapters before this, but this is the first time that he's actually quoted, which I think makes it even more significant. And what he does is he mentions someone who has not yet been mentioned in the whole of this chapter, the whole first 25 verses of this chapter. He mentions God. David says this, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" David's got 3 main speeches in this chapter, and each time his speech is charged with theology. David talks about God. Up until David comes along, as we've seen, this is a godless narrative. But crucially, David's living in a different way to King Saul and the rest of the Israelites. David is living and speaking as though God exists. as though there is a living God. And David is not looking at the outward appearance. He's not quaking in his boots when he sees Goliath's size, his armour, his weapons. David is looking on the heart. And what he sees is somebody who's defying the Israelites, and thereby he's defying the living God. So let's go back to those questions I asked at the beginning. If someone were to eavesdrop on our thoughts, would they know that we believe in a living God? How do we face our Goliaths? Are we living in a godless narrative? Do we need to start thinking and speaking about God? I don't know about you, but I sometimes spend hours and hours worrying about a situation before I remember to pray about it, or before I allow God to show me that situation from his perspective. I'm a Christian, and I've been a Christian for almost as long as I can remember. But I find myself still thinking and talking and behaving as though God doesn't exist. Or I don't even talk about him at all. It's actually very countercultural in our society to talk about God. And even at church, I know that I can often sing all about God, all about his faithfulness, all through church. And then I just small talk my way through coffee time as though God isn't faithful. There's no forgiving saviour. There's no loving father. There's no faithful and comforting spirit. And if we talk about God, it can sometimes give other people the courage to talk about God too. Especially with Christians, but not just with Christians. Fast forwarding a little bit in our story, in verse 37, we see David finally mention the Lord in capital letters, the Lord. And whenever we see the Lord in capitals in the Bible, of course, what that means is it's the English translation of the Hebrew YHWH, Yahweh, the Hebrew name for God. I am the Lord. And what David says in verse 37 is this: the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And that prompts Saul to reply. He replies, go and the Lord be with you. It's as if David mentioning the name of Yahweh gives Saul the courage and strength to speak again of Yahweh. And it's a hard thing to do, but just wanted to challenge you today. How can we bring God into our conversations? It's about our thoughts to start with. We need God thinking to lead into God speaking. Now, there's some people who are so natural at this that it's wonderful to hear them. And there are some of those people right here in this church. Not that they're super spiritual or annoyingly godly, you know, where you feel judged and patronised. I don't mean that kind of speaking about God. When the Holy Spirit is at work in someone and their conversation is just dripping with Jesus, do you know people like that? That gives me the courage. When I hear people talking about God, that gives me the courage to talk about him as well. How can we give people the courage and the strength to speak again of God? And if we can start doing it here inside the church walls, maybe it'll happen a bit more naturally outside the church walls as well. So back to our story. Before he can fight Goliath, David has to persuade King Saul to let him go and fight him, because Saul doesn't want to start with. Saul is falling into the trap of looking at the situation from a human perspective. In verse 33, he says to David, "You are not able to go out against this Philistine and fight him. You're only a boy, and he's been a fighting man from his youth." But in David's reply in verses 34 to 37, he tells Saul all about his experiences as a shepherd. When a lion or a bear came and attacked the sheep, David would kill it and rescue the sheep, in verse 35. And then in 37, he uses the same Hebrew word as the one used for rescuing the sheep, to say, who was it that actually rescued him? The Lord. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me. That's that word deliver again, from the hand of this Philistine. David saying, I rescued the sheep, but actually it was the Lord who rescued me, and he will rescue me again. It's David's testimony of God's deliverance, God's rescuing, that persuades Saul to let him face Goliath. Storytelling is a really important part of the cultural life of the Israelites. We read it all through the Old Testament and in the New Testament. And it's part of the Jewish faith even today, and the Christian faith. For example, built into the Passover festival is the telling of the story again and again, year after year, of God's rescuing of the people of Israel from the hands of the Egyptians. And in this bit of chapter 17, David is telling the story. He's telling the story of how God has delivered him in the past. And this gives him the faith that God will deliver him again. We need to tell our stories. We need to tell our stories of how God has delivered us in the past. We need to tell our stories to one another. But sometimes we also need to tell those stories again to ourselves, to remind ourselves of how God has been faithful to us. So that when we're facing our giants, we can remember how God has delivered us in the past from the lions and the bears. So Saul is persuaded, finally, to let David go. And then there's this comical moment when he tries to put David in his suit of armour. And you can just imagine little David walking around in this massive suit of armour that's way too big for him. It made me think of Bethan sometimes likes to try on John's wellies, and they come up to her tummy, you know, and she sort of tries to walk around and she just falls over. And of course, David says, I don't want this armour. I can't walk in this. I'm not used to it. And instead, he goes to the riverbank, picks up 5 smooth stones, and he goes off to fight the Philistines with nothing more than his staff and his slingshot. Now, we've seen already that armour is really important. It's a really important factor in this story. And the narrator really wants to make a big comparison between the detailed description at the beginning of Goliath's suit of armour and David's lack of armour and weapons and his outright refusal to wear any armour. So this, of course, leads us to think, what might Saul's armour represent as a parallel for our own lives? I read a book recently by an American author called Malcolm Gladwell, he's written books like Blink and The Tipping Point. I don't know if anyone's heard of him. But he recently wrote a book called David and Goliath. And he's not actually known to be a Christian, but he has said in interviews that writing this book made him go back and re-examine his faith. The book is all about underdogs and the reasons why some people seem to succeed against all odds. And he's not writing from a specifically Christian point of view, but his main point is this: giants are not always what you think they are. Often what might seem like their strength is actually their vulnerability or their weakness. And the same is true of underdogs. Often what might seem to be their weakness can turn out to be their great strength. And that's, of course, true of David. And one of the reasons for this, he argues, is that underdogs, when they come to fight giants, do not fight them on their own terms. So David doesn't choose to come up against Goliath wielding a sword or a spear in single combat. He chooses completely different weapons, and it's completely against the giant's expectations. And I think this can so easily be translated into the Christian life as well. As Christians, we can come to fight our giants. I know you'll all have giants in your mind, what that might mean for you, things that you've faced or are facing. We can come to fight our giants knowing that often what feels like our vulnerability, our weakness, could actually be our great strength. David could have chosen to rely on heavy armour and a sword to fight Goliath. And we could similarly choose to put our trust in the things of this world, material wealth, our social standing, qualifications, popularity and fame, physical health, physical strength, power and status. But David knows that he has another weapon up his sleeve. In verse 45, he says this to Goliath, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty." And we can say the same, can't we? We come in the name of the Lord Almighty. We face our giants in the name of the Lord Almighty, who delivers us. And this is a theme of the Bible. Just wanted to whiz through a few verses. I meant to give them to Roger beforehand to put on the screen, but I forgot. Oh, well, I had other things happening with children. But I'll just read a few of them out for you. Psalm 20, verse 7. "Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God." What are you trusting in? What am I trusting in? Am I trusting in my own strength? Psalm 33, verses 16 to 19. "No king is saved by the size of his army. No warrior escapes by his great strength. A horse is a vain hope for deliverance. Despite all its great strength, it cannot save. But the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear him, on those whose hope is in his unfailing love, to deliver them from death." And then we see this going through into the New Testament. This is one of my favourite passages, 2 Corinthians 12, verses 9 to 10, where Paul's talking about his thorn in the flesh, this affliction that God has given him. And he's talking about God. "But he said to me," God said to me, "my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in your weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." David's vulnerability and his apparent weakness is also his great strength, because it gives God the space to demonstrate his power. Goliath's apparent strength and power is also his great weakness, because it makes him rely on his own size and strength, and it makes him defy God. David's very clear that the battle is the Lord's, and that it is God who has enabled him to win this victory. It's not about David's courage, it's not about David's bravery, or even David's skill with a sling. It's God's honour that's at stake. And it is God who delivers David and thereby delivers Israel. I feel a bit like I'm always coming back to the same sermon. Because the first time I ever spoke in Penrath, I spoke about Gideon. And Gideon was an underdog, if ever there was one. And we see God use somebody who seems really unlikely to actually win this amazing battle. God's power is made perfect in Gideon's weakness. And then last time I came and spoke here, you might remember, I spoke about how God has chosen the foolish things of this world to shame the wise. And I spoke about how so many of the things that we hold on to, our wealth, our class, our health, our cleverness, these aren't important to God. We have to remember that these things can actually be like Saul's armour in that they get in the way and they become false props to rely on, when in fact we rely on the name of the Lord. Sort of asking myself why I keep returning to this theme, and it goes back to that chapter 16, verse 7. That's what God's like. God doesn't look at outward appearances. He doesn't look at how big our house is, or how much we earn, or how well we did at school, or how pretty we are, or how many friends we've got on Facebook, or whether we've managed to find a life partner or not. All those things the world looks at, the world judges us by. But God looks at the heart. And sometimes the things that seem to be our greatest inadequacies, our failures, our sicknesses, our struggles, we might find that those things are actually our greatest strength. So how might God be speaking to you today? Are you living in a godless narrative, as though there is no living God? Do you need to let God break into your thoughts, your words, your actions? Do you need to start looking at your situation from God's point of view instead of a human point of view? Do you need to start speaking and living as though God does exist, God is real? Maybe you need to remember some of the things that God's done for you in the past, how he's rescued you, how he's saved you, how he's delivered you, and start retelling some of those old stories. Maybe we need as a church to be telling those stories to one another, reminding each other of God's faithfulness to each one of us and to us as a church. Maybe we need to stop trying to fight giants on their terms. But most of all, I just want to say, be encouraged. Giants are not what we think they are. Sometimes giants can look pretty scary and pretty invulnerable. But God looks at the heart. God looks for people who are willing to trust him and who are willing to live for his glory. And you might find that what you thought was your greatest weakness could be your greatest strength as God's power is made perfect in your weakness.